This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 110. Today we speak with Michael Hagen about his book, The Christian Lover. Christ the Center is listener-supported, and we thank everyone who helps to make this program possible. To read more about how you can contribute, please visit reformedforum.org/donate.
Hi, this is Nick Batzig with Christ the Center, and I am very pleased to welcome Dr. Michael Hagen to the show this morning. Hi, Dr. Hagen, how are you doing?
I'm well. Good to be here.
Dr. Hagen is the professor of church history and biblical spirituality at Southern Seminary. He is also the director of the Andrew Fuller Center for Baptist Studies at Southern Seminary, and we are very pleased to have him on the show this morning to talk with him about a book that Reformation Trust recently published called The Christian Lover. Now, this was a book that you published with your daughter, is that correct, Victoria?
Yeah, my daughter helped me in terms of the assembly of some of the biographical sections of it.
Okay, and it is essentially a compilation of a few short letters from different men in church history from the Reformation forward, Protestant ministers, many of whom are well known, Martin Luther, John Calvin, Philip Doddridge, Martin Lloyd-Jones. And it's an interesting little book. I actually have to say that at the outset, I was sort of surprised when I came to it and read it. I expected it would be more strong love poetry, sort of, more of what we think in modern day about romance with, Nicholas Sparks and The Notebook. And as you read it, it's really rich with devotional, theological care and concern, a very different picture of love and care than the world really gives you, with just the mere being caught up with the person for being caught up with the person. And actually, it was interesting in one of the letters, and I forget if it was Doddridge's wife, but there was that concern that they were not making an idol out of the husband or the wife that God had given them. So I found it to be a very, very intriguing book. I wanted to ask you, in your research, as you approach the subject, what was it that led you to compile these letters and to write this book? Was it something that came about just from your own study of first sources, and you came upon different letters, or was it something you purposefully set out to do for a specific reason?
Yeah, I think it's probably a bit of both. Probably the first figure in the book that I would have been reading about in terms of love letters would have been Samuel Pierce, and that's about 20 years ago now when I first came across a bundle or collection of letters of about 75 letters from him to his wife, and in the Regent's Park College archives in Oxford University. And that really kind of sparked an interest in terms of this sort of genre. And so over the years, I kept track of these sorts of things. And then I think I also began to become aware on a very different level of the great need for theological reflection on marriage in the context of theological education. And that because I began to see that there was, firstly, in the curriculum that I was involved in most of the seminary context, there was very little material spent on that. And yet this is obviously a vital area of a minister's life or a pastor's life or a Christian worker's life, generally speaking. And coupled with that, the breakdown of a number of marriages of students that I saw, men that I thought had great potential, within 2 to 5 years were, after graduation, were out of ministry completely because of the collapse of their marriages. And I began to realize that there was a serious deficiency in my mind on terms of what they were getting. There was an area of deficiency, let me say that, in terms of their theological education. And so I began to do a number of lectures that focused on this area, and it grew into a book.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting. I mean, one of the things I was struck with, as I said already, was the way that in these letters, the way that the men and the women speak about their spouse, whether to each other or to others, that they're expressing this deep spiritual love and care, but not to the expense of their relationship with the Lord, you know, not putting the spouse before the Lord. And in doing that, then learning to love them properly. And I was really struck with that in my own marriage. I you know, thought about my own responsibility to my wife and how, you know, what is the supreme way that I show love to her is really by loving the Lord and wanting her to grow as my, you know, co-heir of the grace of life, as Peter says. So I really appreciated that about this book. It I didn't expect it necessarily coming to it. You make the point in here that the Reformation really revived our understanding of marriage. Could you talk a little bit about that? I think you say that in the little short summary of Luther.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's critical to see in the history of Christian marriage that there was a real low point during that long period called the Middle Ages. And that for a variety of reasons. Critical to that was certainly the theological notion that celibacy was a higher plane of Christian discipleship than marriage. And that certainly is pushed by men like Jerome at the end of the Roman the empire. And Jerome, when he's asked about should young women get married, advises them not to, but to basically kind of retreat into a nunnery. And Jerome is a very influential figure. He's the translator of the Bible into Latin, becomes known as a very significant theological figure, and thus had enormous influence. Even in Augustine, who is nowhere near as acidic regarding marriage, also fails, I think, to understand appropriately the biblical reasons for marriage. And, for example, in his commentaries on Genesis, he asked the question, if Eve could not have had children for Adam, would she have been of any value to him? And the answer is no. And so marriage becomes primarily, for Augustine, a context for procreation, a reflection, yes, of Christ's love for his church, but the whole area of spiritual companionship is not there. Or if it's there, it's deeply minimized. And so the heritage of the church coming into the Middle Ages was one in which discipleship was seen to be the zealous discipleship for Christ was seen to be in the province of those who had committed themselves to a life of celibacy. And not surprisingly, marriage suffered deeply. And then coming into the latter part of the Middle Ages, you have the massive corruption that was part of the Roman Catholic Church, in which you had men who were celibate, priests, that is, men who were celibate but not chaste. And so marriage, the whole period of the Reformation is one of great turmoil regarding marriage. What is marriage? What's its value? Etc. And the Reformers, by God's grace, rediscover, obviously, critical issues like justification by faith alone, the nature of true worship, but they also rediscover Christian marriage.
Do you think there's a development? I know you don't really deal with this per se in the book, except just by reading these men in chronological succession, but do you think there's a development in Reformation, post-Reformation understanding of marriage relationship, appreciation for, maybe because of the examples of men? I know I took a course with Joel Beakey recently where he read, and all these quotes are in the back of Living for God's Glory or whatever that compilation volume was that came out last year, where he has all the Puritan quotes about the beauty of marriage and really the just the amazing way these men viewed it. Do you think there's, from Luther to the Puritans and then onward, sort of a development in that understanding?
Yeah, I do. I think that what Luther rediscovers and begins to lay out, I think the Puritans probably take a number of steps further. And there is definitely an enrichment of theological reflection and pastoral pastoral discussion of marriage when you move from the Reformation into the Puritans. By and large, the Puritans embraced the Reformation view of marriage, but give it a lot more prolonged thought and reflection. And so that John Calvin's, for example, rather isolated comments about marriage found in his commentaries here and there in theological tracts are now developed into significant treatises on marriage.
Right.
And yes, there is definitely a development as you move from the Reformers into the Puritans. And the Puritans, it's a deepening and an enrichment rather than a completely different line.
Right, right. I was intrigued in your chapter on John Calvin, where you say Calvin had drawn up a list of the attributes he sought for a wife, and you give the quote where he tells Pharaoh on one occasion he was looking for a woman who was chaste, sober-minded, prudent, patient, and able to take care of my health. And I thought that was interesting because I had a good friend when I was a new Christian, and I was wanting a Christian wife, a godly wife, and I didn't have any sort of grid outside of my own parents' marriage to really think about how I needed to be praying for that, other than, you know, she had to be a Christian. And my friend said, you know, I'm praying all these attributes that she's godly, wise, prudent, humble, virtuous, and probably got it from here. He probably heard it from someone mentioning this about Calvin. And so I began praying those things. And I think that's a amazing example, because oftentimes young men don't think about praying for specific attributes. And it also shows, as I've been teaching through Genesis, you see the contrast between Abraham's servant praying that God would show him the woman that he has for Isaac according to her kindness, and, you know, if she would give the camels water, rather than her mere beauty, physical beauty. But then you see with Jacob, just this, in rapture with the beauty of Rachel, that contrast. And it seems here with Calvin that that these men, because of their commitment to the Lord, were really looking for that inner beauty in their wives.
Yeah, I think that if there is no clear reflection and solid reflection on what you're looking for in a wife, then the cultural model what's prevalent in our culture will then begin to dominate your thinking. There has to be that, I think, and that's another reason why I think this is a very important area, that there needs to be consistent reflection on the nature of marriage. And if there isn't, as I said, then filling that vacuum will be what our culture believes to be a good marriage. And increasingly in our culture, I think image is very central. Rather than substance, and external beauty rather than virtue.
Yes, with regard to the actual rhetorical style of the letters, I thought it was interesting reading the different letters that you've included in this book, because they all have a very different style, and it seems that when you get to John Hutchinson, that and you mentioned this, I think Hutchinson is the one that copies Milton's style, or perhaps it was Doddridge, but you see more of this strongly poetic writing of these letters, whereas before they go from sort of just mere information, communication, conversational, to more poetic. Do you see that as something that was really just a constant development, a very consistent thing, that these sort of love letters became more poetic?
No, not necessarily. I think what's reflected there is the different context in which the different recipients to which the letters are being sent. In the case of the Hutchinson letter, it's the wife, Lucy, writing after to her children about the nature of her marriage to her husband, John Hutchinson, who had been arrested because of his involvement in the Puritan Commonwealth, and once the king was restored, became a person who was suspect politically. And she's reminding her children what her own relationship was to their father, and what that marriage was like. And so it inevitably is going to take on a different genre than a letter that would be written directly to the person. And so I think what you're seeing there is something of the different context in which the letters are written. And then again, you're also dealing with different people who express themselves differently. And so a John Broadus, for example, his expressions of love to his wife during the American Civil War period are quite different than, say, a John Calvin or Martin Luther.
You see a common theme as you read through a lot of these letters of really a high esteem of the Lord's Day and worship and the role that that plays in the relationship between the husband and the wife. I forget exactly who it was I was reading where that was kind of a reoccurring theme where the minister was telling his wife how much, you know, he was looking forward to the Sabbath day, how much he was looking forward to being refreshed and strengthened, or that he had a good Lord's Day, and that that was really the high point of their lives. I found that to be interesting because we often don't think about, you know, public worship and the Lord's Day as something that is really, you know, the high point of our life here on earth. In the time during our pilgrimage. So I found that to be very intriguing. I think that there's a lesson there for a lot of young men, as you say, even in seminary, to think about that ought to be a day of joy and gladness and seeing the relationship with your wife in light of the relationship of worship and public worship. Did you find, as you did your research, did you find anything that jumped out at you that really affected you, or that maybe you didn't know that you learned in your study of these letters?
Yes, I think so. Certainly the sort of material that, for instance, you find with, the Martin Lloyd-Jones, I think I've only got one or two of his letters. It's certainly not the sort of picture I had of Lloyd-Jones at all, and the way he expresses himself to his wife. I think the thing that reminded me, that there was the again and again reminded by the letters that I worked with, was the importance, as you've mentioned, of spiritual nurture and spiritual companionship. That their marriage, because it was a Christian marriage, had a dimension that was quite different from any other marriage. And there are good marriages in the history of mankind, history of Western culture, for example. We probably know good marriages today that the participants in those marriages are not Christians. But there is an added dimension. A richer dimension that is there when you have two Christians married, and that because of the spiritual element. And that was driven home to me, I think, again and again, and that a good marriage from a biblical standpoint is not simply the ability of two human beings to live together in harmony and to work together, but it has that dimension of being preparation for glory and a school of sanctification, non-biblical marriages obviously would not have. So I think that was driven home to me. Also, I think the depth of love that you see exhibited. Again, I'm thinking here of the broadest letter, but Thomas Charles and his letters to his wife, Thomas Charles of Bala, the Calvinistic Methodist, or Philip Doddridge. Probably the other area too is that for some of them, and again, this is not a uniform, but I think is partly the characters. There's an element of playfulness in some of these, especially Doddridge and his relationship with his wife. There was a winsomeness there that was very attractive.
Right, right. I was also really impressed with the care that the husbands and wives expressed to one another concerning their children in a number of these letters. I think it was the letters of Calvin concerning his wife's children. I wasn't quite clear about that. Did she have children from the previous marriage? Is that your understanding?
Yeah, she had been married prior to her marriage to Calvin, and she'd been married to an Anabaptist.
Right.
And he had subsequently embraced Reformed theology under the preaching of Calvin, but had died of the plague. And so she brought two children, a boy and a girl, into that, into the marriage with Calvin.
Right. And I found it very, very, very interesting the way she said to him, he promising her at, when she's dying, that he's going to care for the children. And she says, well, I've committed them to God, and so I know you'll care for what I've committed to God, because she knew the great sobriety with which Calvin, you know, approached everything concerning the Lord and concerning his responsibility. And then there's that reverse thing where she said, essentially, I'm committing them to you, and I know you'll commit them to the Lord, and the care there. And then Samuel Pierce, and I want to read this to our listeners. In one letter, he says, why do I attempt to console? Perhaps an indulgent providence has ere now dissipated your fears, or if that same kind providence had removed our babe, you have consolation enough in him who suffered more than we, and more than enough to quiet all our passions in that astonishing consideration. God so loved the world that he spared not his own son. Did God cheerfully give the holy child Jesus for us, and shall we refuse our child to him? He gave his son to suffer. He takes our children to enjoy, yes, to enjoy himself. And just that, you know, I think about Malachi and saying, why does God make them one? He seeks godly offspring. And the way that these mm-hmm. people took the seriousness of raising children that belong to the Lord. So I really appreciated that.
Yeah, there's probably a whole book. There is definitely another book there that would relate to the whole area of children and parents. But that, I mean, while I think biblically the heart of marriage lies in the whole area of companionship, yet children are a vital part of that relationship. And that also is an area that is disturbing, I think, in some Christian circles, where today you have parents, Christian parents, seemingly opting to think about the possibility of not even having children. And certainly that reflects our culture. And so you see a very, very different perspective here regarding children, the joy that children are in marriage, and the marriage is a solid marriages are the context in which God would have children raised.
Right. Do you see a loss in our own day of something of the appreciation for and the care that these men and women express towards one another in Christian marriage, because we don't have as many trials as they did? Often in these letters and throughout church history, you read about the way, you know, one wife dies young, or the children die, or the husband's traveling and you don't have the instantaneousness of, you know, getting on a plane and being somewhere so quickly, and you're away from one another for a while. And just all the trials and the difficulties of life then actually drawing them closer together. Or do you think that's just circumstantial?
I think that certainly is part of the way in which men and women sense their need of one another. There were challenges that they experienced that are not normally the experience of the average Western Christian today. The enormous number of deaths of children. The Doddridges buried, I think, all but three or four of their children. They had about a dozen under the age of two or three. Cotton Mather, who I don't have in the book, he buried 13 out of 15 children under the age of three. And so while these, you read these families had enormous numbers of children, but at any one given time, they probably only had two or three that were living. And that obviously is going to have a deep impact upon a marriage, without a shadow of a doubt. And either embitter it, or by God's grace, give it a gentleness and a deep reliance upon God. So I think there is that factor, but I do think also that. Part of the challenge of thinking through biblically about marriage today is that our cultural view of marriage is increasingly at odds with the biblical model.
Yes.
And that would not have been as much the case in certain bygone generations. In the 18th century, possibly, but in other periods, even in the Puritan period, the Puritans obviously, I think, had a very profound understanding of marriage. But marriage in the larger surrounding culture, at least in the first half of the 17th century, would have approached in some respects, because there was a large diffusion of Protestantism in that world. The Puritans disagreeing with others in the Church of England, by and large, over issues of how far the Reformation needs to go. But nonetheless, you've got people married in a church service with a Christian explanation of what marriage is to be.
Mm.
And so the ideal, or what I'm saying is the ideals of marriage in the larger culture would have been closer to the biblical model than we have today. Today, it's a time of massive confusion, absolutely massive confusion.
Yes.
Where we're trying to redefine marriage and are engaged in a significant social experiment on a level that I don't think Western culture has seen since the ancient world.
Right.
And the long-term impact of this, unless it's checked, I think will be devastating.
Yes, I agree.
And so we're living in a bit of a different cultural scenario than most of the people in these letters experienced. And the dissonance between their understanding of marriage and the larger culture's understanding of marriage would not have been as great as there is today, which I think even more reason why we need to give serious theological reflection and prayerful consideration to what marriage is from a biblical standpoint.
Yes, and we in the Western world take in so much through Hollywood and television. And, you know, I heard this growing up from ministers who, you know, sought to give the correctives to understandings about what marriage was, but it's not really until you're in a marriage relationship as a Christian in America that you realize how much everything that you're taking in from society around you is affecting the way you think about what love is, what true care is, what the marriage is supposed to look like, what the purpose of the marriage is. I recently had a couple over for marital counseling, been married 21 years and have just not had a good marriage. And I think a lot of that, the problem is that they have not had biblical teaching and examples like the examples you give in this book of what a godly marriage, what God intends a marriage to look like. So I very much appreciate what you've done here with this work in that regard. I did want to ask you a question because I've said now twice that, you know, you do read, especially in the earlier letters, this concern not to make an idol out of your spouse and this deep spiritual care for them to grow in grace, to grow in their love for Christ and to worship the Lord together. And yet, when you come to Martin Lloyd-Jones, as you've already said, you were kind of, you didn't expect the picture that you got when you read this letter. But he says, and I just want to read this to our listeners, he tells his wife, "I have told you many, many times the passing of the years does nothing but deepen and intensify my love for you. When I think of those days in London in 1925 and 26, when I thought that no greater love was possible, I could laugh. But honestly, during this last year, I had come to believe that it was not possible for a man to love his wife more than I loved you. And yet I see that there is no end to love and that it is still true that absence makes the heart grow fonder. I am quite certain that there is no lover anywhere writing to his girl who is quite as mad about her as I am." And, you know, I guess I wonder sometimes when I hear men say, well, you don't want to make an idol of your wife. And I understand what they're saying, but biblically, you know, I'm called to love my wife as Christ loves the church. And he gave himself, he gave everything for her. I understand that you can have a sinful approach to marriage and a sinful cleaving to your spouse, but Do you think that the greater problem is that we don't love our spouses enough the way that Lloyd Jones has this love here for his wife?
Yeah, I think that's the greater problem in our culture. Again, it's and without going into a very, very significant depth analysis and reflection on some of these cultural contexts in times past, it would be difficult to know what was the greatest challenge in those cultures. Was it because of the fragility of life and other reasons that you had men so passionately in love with their wives that their love for their wives was almost idolatrous? I don't think that's the challenge for us today. I think the challenge for us today is having a rich biblical love for one's wife that you find reflected in that letter from Lloyd Jones to his wife, Bethan. Mm. I think everything in our culture bespeaks infidelity. Everything in terms of advertising media, all the way through to various other forms of media that people listen to and watch. Infidelity is the whole concept of if the feeling is no longer there, then I need to get out of the relationship.
Right, and that's so selfish and mm-hmm. warped and backwards from the view we see biblically of Christ loving us when we were unlovable.
Yeah. So I think the challenge is not so much the challenge that some of these men felt, and I would be very hesitant to say that some of these men's experience that they were fearful of making their wives idols, that challenged their love for the Lord, that they misunderstood what was happening in marriage. The cultural context, you would have to, may well have been one in which that was a danger.
Right.
But I don't think that's so much our danger today.
I don't either. I think that's true. Would you mind telling our listeners a little bit about, and I'm probably not going to pronounce his name properly, but Moltke, is that how you say that? Count Moltke?
Oh, yes. James Helmut von Moltke.
Von Moltke. And would you mind telling why did you choose him? I mean, this is not someone that is really well known in church history like the other men that you chose to include their letters.
Well, von Moltke, again, would be someone I came across probably a bit after Samuel Pierce, somewhere in the late 80s, when I was doing a significant amount of work and reading on the confessing church in Germany, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and what it meant to be a German Christian during the Nazi regime. And von Moltke presented himself as an alternative to Bonhoeffer. And there are certain areas of Bonhoeffer's thought I obviously have theological problems with, but there's a lot of his thought that I really appreciate. But one of the areas that I struggled with was his decision to use engage in violence against the state, and to be actively involved in the plot to kill Hitler.
Right.
And von Moltke also was adamantly opposed, like Bonhoeffer, right from the beginning of the Nazi regime, to Nazism. He saw through it, unlike many, many others in Germany at the time. And but he believed that if the Christian took up arms against the state, and especially the Nazi regime, he would end up becoming really a little different from them. And so his opposition was expressed in very, very different ways. After the July 1944 attempt to assassinate Hitler, he was arrested along with a variety of other people. He was on the out, kind of the fringes of a group called the Front. He was at the heart, but he was at the fringes of this plot to kill Hitler. Associations with men who were involved that led to his arrest. But definitely he was involved in a group called the Kreisau Circle, who were opposed to Hitler and planning how to rebuild Germany along Christian lines after the end of the war, and they were assuming Hitler would be defeated. And he was a remarkable man. He came from a military tradition. He didn't go into the military. His great uncle was the commander in chief of the German army from 1914 to 1916 in the first 3 years of the First World War, and so he had a very recognizable name in Germany at the time. He was an aristocrat, a very wealthy industrialist as well, and his opposition to Hitler was very significant. But undergirding it was this commitment to Christ. And his great delight, he told his wife at his trial, was the fact that eventually it came down to this, that he was going to be executed because he was a Christian, not because he was an aristocrat and Hitler hated the aristocracy in Germany, and nor because he was a wealthy industrialist, but simply because of this. And at one point in the trial, the judge, a man named Freisler, asked him, who do you take orders from, the Führer or from above, naming God? And von Moltke said, all disguises were off at that point. He said, it was quite clear to me and to him, that is the judge, that I was on trial for my being a Christian. And his last, one of his last letters to his wife, I think it is probably the last letter, is just a tremendous example of his understanding of vocation, what his marriage meant as part of that vocation, and his love for his wife, and the fact that that love would endure. It would obviously be in a different realm, a different vein, but it's just a tremendous, I think, example of a Christian marriage in a context of really, it's a horrific context. You think of trying to live as a Christian in Nazi Germany.
I know.
And here you see, I think, the example of how you can, even in that horrific context, be faithful to Christ.
Yes, that's wonderful. And it's interesting in his letters how much he is clinging to the Word of God. I, you know, have often quoted Bunyan when he's in prison in the Bedford jail. And he says in that short account of his imprisonment, you know, the scriptures were never as open to me, and Jesus Christ was never as revealed to me as he has been now. And if it were lawful, I would ask for more sufferings that I may know more of Christ. And you see something of that in von Moltke's letters, where he is quoting Isaiah and quoting 2 Corinthians and, you know, pouring out his heart to his wife, showing her how much he is clinging to the Word of God and the truths of Christ and the Christian life. And it really is an encouraging set of letters that you've included. I wanted to ask you, as we round up here, well, let me put you on the spot, actually. Do you write letters to your wife? Because letter writing is really, as everybody knows, a lost art now. And I'm wondering, do you do that? Do you think it's a good idea for us to try to cultivate that in our own marriages?
I do. And I do. yes to both questions. I mean, I do write notes to my wife and et cetera. And I do think it is something we need to cultivate. In this regard, without wanting these letters to be simply something that men copy out, you know, verbatim, I think it would be something that would be, a great byproduct of reading a book like this, is to realize the importance of that medium of communication, a way of expressing in a concrete form, in a physical, you know, form that can be kept, one's love for one's wife. I do think so. I think it's important. You know, when time has passed and our lives are done, the question that one might ask is, what record is there of our marriages? And the reason why these marriages are important is because they set before our eyes what it means for two Christians to commit themselves to one another in marriage. And will there be examples of that in a written form today?
Right.
Would there be, you know, if 100 years from now people were looking back at our day, you know, will they be able to find these sorts of things that from which they can reconstruct marriages, Christian marriages.
Right.
And for that reason alone, I think it's important that there might be a legacy left. But I think also it's a way, sometimes things can be said in a letter or in a written note that cannot be said as easily in another vehicle. And I think it is important that men try to cultivate this sort of art.
Yes. Yeah, it's interesting. And I don't know how to explain this, except that there is something about letter writing. I mean, obviously God has written us love letters in, mm-hmm. in scripture, mm-hmm. as you know, and, mm-hmm. There's something about letter writing that is different than just speaking, to one another. You can pour your heart out in a certain way. And I don't understand why that's different, but, I have certainly been challenged to think about my own relationship with my wife as a result of reading this, and, have often thought about what kind of legacy am I leading? I mean, what kind of legacy am I leaving now as people see my marriage? But, you know, when I'm gone, how will people understand my relationship with my wife? And was that a godly example? So I greatly appreciated that. You've taught some of this at school. You've said that.
Yes, some of this material, like the Samuel Pierce, for instance, is part of a lecture that I would do. The Calvin material I've actually worked up into a full lecture.
Okay.
And Richard Baxter, who I didn't include in the book, I do a full lecture on him as well.
Okay.
On his marriage. And so, in the courses I do on church history, the survey courses which students would take in a typical seminary, they do a couple of survey courses. In the second one, which deals with the Reformation normally to the modern day, I will include at least one or two lectures that deal with marriage.
Okay, and I know we've already talked about a lot of the things that are covered in this book and that you would wish to say. Is there any other advice that you give your students, future ministers? We have a large audience of seminarians, pastors, theologians, and so what advice would you want to give to men like us in the ministry or preparing to go that maybe hasn't been said this hour?
Well, I think the great importance of building deep roots in one's marriage and guarding one's heart. I'm quite certain that the men who whose marriages I have seen fall apart didn't expect that at the beginning of those marriages.
Right.
And the collapse of their marriages didn't just happen in a moment. And again, this is a reason why the writing of love notes to one's spouse is important. It's a way of building strength, and that strength is built by little, not only the big acts, but the little deeds of love. And likewise, a marriage collapses not so much. I'm sure there are examples of ones where it's just a sudden catastrophic fall, but I think for most of them, if you track back, you will see that there have been decisions made or things failed to have been done. And so that's critical, I think, the guarding of the heart.
Yes.
And the recognition that failure in this area is devastating.
Yes.
For one's ministry. And for many of these men, it's the end of it.
Right. And I know it's very easy to put your ministry above your family. It's very easy. I'm a church planter. It's very easy, especially in my situation where the demands can seem just overwhelming all the time. And you have to sift through what is priority, what is not priority. And I have to purposely step back and, as one minister friend of mine in this presbytery says, you know, you need to date your wife. And so
yep.
My wife and I have to now set aside, and we want to set aside Friday nights or whenever and say that is going to be our date night, even if it's only a few hours together doing something we enjoy. Is that something that you practice in your marriage as you have time?
Yes, we do. And it wouldn't be necessarily as formal as, you know, it's every Friday night. But I purposely make sure that there are times on a regular basis when my wife and I spend time together. And it might simply be just going out and, you know, to a coffee shop and
right.
walking through a mall. it doesn't have to necessarily be, you know, as taking my wife to a concert or whatever. But the vital importance is keeping those lines of communication open and spending time together and indicating to the other person that you definitely do treasure them. I didn't include any of there. I mean, there are some mediocre marriages in the history of the church. For example, I think George Whitefield's marriage was mediocre.
Mm.
And essentially what he wanted in a wife was somebody to be a housekeeper.
Yeah, utilitarian kind of purpose.
And that's all too easily where a marriage can drift into, unless there is a purposeful determination that the way they began, which marriages normally begin with, you know, with delight and joy, that be maintained throughout it.
Let me ask you just as we close here about Jonathan Edwards. You've done a lot of work on Edwards. I've read a lot of Edwards. We here at the Forum love Jonathan Edwards. He is often criticized as not having had a good marriage because of the time that he spent studying, you know, the book, I Married a Difficult Man. He obviously spent time with his family. Would you say, because a lot of us do get caught up with Jonathan Edwards as, because he's such a great theologian, would you say that he did probably fell short in that area, or would you say that's a misperception?
That's a misperception. And I know the book by Elizabeth Dodds. I'm not completely happy with all of her portrayal in the book. But Edwards had a tremendous marriage. And what was remarkable about the marriage is, I think, that Sarah had a spiritual maturity that matched his.
Yes, yes.
And there's no shadow of a doubt that in the 18th century, he's the foremost theologian in the Western world, both in terms of his ability to think through biblical concepts and issues, but also in terms of probably the matching of that with rich Christian experience. But Sarah was his spiritual equal when it came to piety.
Mm.
And they had a tremendous marriage. There is a book written by a woman named Moore called Good Christians, Good Husbands, question mark.
Mm.
And she looks at three marriages, the John Wesley's, George Whitefield's, and Jonathan Edwards, which are all three contemporaries. And the one that is the tremendous marriage is that of Edwards. And there isn't a ton of material to illustrate this, but there is eyewitness accounts by Samuel Hopkins, who lived in the home for a year and a half.
Right.
There is some correspondence of Edwards to his wife.
Okay.
Remarkably very little. Remarkably not as much as one would expect.
Because he wrote letters to his Scottish correspondents and to all these others.
Well, we have about 5,000 letters of Heinrich Bullinger, who lived 200 years before Edwards, and we've got about 275 of Edwards.
Right.
And for some reason, the letters didn't survive, mostly.
Right.
And so we only have a handful to his wife, but the ones that we do have are tremendous. And also, right at the beginning, we have that remarkable little kind of meditation on his wife.
Right.
That is being passed down, and then his final kind of letter to his wife, which he talks about their uncommon union.
Hmm.
And I think that's a misperception. I think that he had a very, very, very tremendous relationship with Sarah.
And I recently came across a letter he wrote to his son Timothy, called A Letter to My Son Timothy, and it's in one of the Yale editions.
Yep.
And it's this amazing letter of this father longing to see his son know the Lord. If he doesn't know the Lord, he is either sick or he's just come over a sickness, and Edwards is making use of that. And I even think he mentions his mother's care, and you see that the tight familial concern, and it's just a beautiful letter that he writes to his son Timothy. So I appreciate you clearing that up, because I do think that the prevailing notion is that Edwards was not an exemplary husband, father, and there seem to be clues that it was otherwise. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, there is a tremendous little entry. One of his children, Esther Edwards, who married Aaron Burr Sr. and was the mother, therefore, of the third Vice President of the United States.
Right.
Aaron Burr Jr. She kept a diary for about 3 years, and in one of her diary entries, she talks about a conversation she had with her father, and this is after she's been married a few years, and she's he had given her advice on spiritual warfare, and what she said, how to keep the soul close to God, and she ends it by saying, what a gift to have such a father, such a guide. The evidence that we have from all of the children, except for maybe Pierpont, who was the youngest, who would have been only maybe 5 or 6 when his father died, is that there is a tremendous love for their father and respect for their father and mother.
Mm.
And that household, Edwards did make some mistakes, I think, in his pastoral ministry.
Yes.
But in his household, he was exemplary.
Right. That's wonderful. Well, we want to thank you for taking
thank
the time
you.
To be with us. This has been really rewarding. I appreciate you taking the time to write this little book. I want to recommend it to all our listeners. It is called The Christian Lover, The Sweetness of Love and Marriage in the Letters of Believers, written by Michael and Victoria Haken. That is a Reformation Trust publication. You can go there to Ligonier's website to order it. You can probably find it at Westminster Theological Seminary Bookstore. I want to encourage all the men who are listening to this, and women for that matter, to get a copy of this. I think that it is richly rewarding in its historical approach, in the first source letters that it provides. It's a real blend of church history and biblical spirituality, which is exactly what Dr. Haken teaches at Southern Seminary. I think it also shows the value of studying church history and historical theology, something that is just underestimated in our day and underappreciated, and you'll really see the rich reward of studying first sources in church history. So we want to encourage you to get that. You can find us on the web at reformforum.org. You can find more on our blogs from feedingonchrist.com and bringthebooks.org. And again, Dr. Haken, we want to thank you for being with us on Christ the Center.